This is Luxury.
And Diallo.
The hosts of One Song. And we'd like to thank the United Soybean Board for the sustainable makeover of our podcast studio and for sparking discussions on greener Hollywood production. Check out the Tears for Fears episode of One Song and see behind-the-scenes clips of how they pulled the whole look together. It's all on at Heartbeat Audio on YouTube, and the link is in our show notes.
Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because... I love the charcoal mask.
Great, because why would I put that on my face when I could drop it in my sink?
This is what I get for multitasking. Ugh, why is charcoal so sticky?
Hello?
Hey, Janice. I am so sorry. I thought I was on mute. No, we don't need to reschedule. I'll just stay off camera. Ooh, yeah, that happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed.
And now, join Kevin Hart as he dives into the minds of some of the world's funniest comedians. This is Comedy Gold Mines with Kevin Hart.
Welcome, world. Welcome to an all-new episode of Comedy Gold Mines, where we do what? I shouldn't have to ask. I should not have to ask, because by this time, you should know what we do. We get inside the minds of amazing comedians, and oh my God, what amazing minds they are. There's no mind like the mind of a comedian.
You're going to get my mind?
That's right. I'm getting your mind. Ladies and gentlemen, today's guest, the man, the myth, the legend, Ray Romano. How you doing, man?
I'm all right, man. How are you?
I am good. Dude, pleasure to talk to you. I got to start off by saying I'm a fan. I have been a fan, and I've run into you a couple times. I've never really been able to sit down and talk and, like, really, really chop it up with you, but I've met you in New York, and, you know, we shook hands, and it was quick. It was like a hey, man, how you doing type of thing. Yeah. This is years ago. But, you know, I've seen just your rise and your success. And, you know, I'm in awe of anybody that achieves the unachievable in this craft of comedy, man. So I just want to start off by just giving you your flowers and just saying, like, dude, it's dope to finally talk to you.
Well, you too. Whatever you just said to me, same to you, man. Where did we meet? You remember?
It was in New York, Cellar. You were at
the cellar.
The
Cellar? Yeah.
Yes, you were at the Cellar.
Yeah.
And it was like a quick thing. It was like, hi, how you doing, man? I was younger, so I was timid. I was very, I wasn't as confident as I am now to say, how you doing, man? I'm Kevin Hart, and shake your hand. How you doing? Oh my God, man, hey, good to meet you. It was quick.
Yeah.
Very, very quick. Where are you at now? Where do you stay?
I'm in LA. I live in LA, in the Valley.
In the Valley?
Yeah.
You heard how loud my house was before we started, and I told you I got four kids. You come from a big household as well. How many kids do you have, Ray?
I got four, but I have twins, so I got three tries, four kids. Yeah.
Three tries.
Yeah. I have a girl and three boys. Yeah. Twin, identical twin.
Three tries.
Yes. I'm one over par.
You know, what I admired about you the most, man, is, you know, in stand up, man, you really embrace the household. You really embrace the world of being a father. And, you know, I too am a comic that dove into the side of family just within my material, just talking about marriage, the kids, et cetera. And I found happiness in that because, you know, it was almost like shining a light on this world that I felt nobody else could quite understand unless I gave them my take on it, my POV. Because I know there's a lot of dads that are dealing with their kids, but I was like, if I tell them the shit that I'm dealing with, I'm bring some positive light to these fathers and give them some things to laugh at that they probably don't think to laugh at. You, sir, you've done that. You've done that for years. Your style of comedy, where did you get it from, Ray? Was it something that you just kind of you stepped into and kind of shaped and molded and figured out as you went on? Or was it always a conscious effort for you to kind of talk about the world of marriage and fatherhood?
I didn't make an effort to pick what I wanted to talk about. You know, I mean, when I started stand-up, I wasn't married. I hadn't even met my wife yet when I started stand-up. Mm-hmm. But I just found myself writing about, my observations on what I was going through in life. You know how it is. Some guys are topical. Some guys are characters. Some guys political. I'm like you. I write about what I experience. Mm-hmm. And so then I wrote about being in an Italian family. I wrote about dating. I wrote about being a neurotic, being a hypochondriac. And then I got engaged and I wrote about that. And then my career, stand-up career, didn't really start rising until I did have a wife and kids, you know? Mm-hmm. The first time I did Carson, my 30-year anniversary was last week of the time I did Carson.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Congratulations, man.
On November 15th, 2 weeks ago, 1991. And my daughter was 1 year old, you know, and that's what I was doing then. I was talking about being a new father and being this. I didn't make a conscious effort. That's what I wrote. You know, it's like, I don't think you sit down and say, okay, let me write about this now. Let me write about that. You write what hits you and what strikes you as funny and what you come up with. And who, you know, if I'm being honest, Cosby was my first album that I had. Cosby was the first comedy album I listened to. And, you know, his that style of comedy is what appealed to me. And I like all of it. I like all the comedy. But I was drawn into that kind of storytelling, you know?
You know what's crazy? I see it in your style. I can tell. You know, you can just tell who a comic was influenced by or you know, who a comic has a liking for, towards, et cetera. And right. I can see it. Right. I too, right. You know, of course, the regardless of the personal choices that this person has made, you right. know, I'm a Cosby yeah. Kraft fan, right? Within the world of comedy, his style, his method, the way that he approached it was dope as hell. And I tried to edgy mine up a little bit and have like a sense of rawness to it. And I think that's probably where the Eddie influence came in as well, because, you know, Eddie was a storyteller too. So I gravitated toward those, yeah. Those comics that told stories, the comics that really flourished yeah. in just talking about their real, their now, their environment, good or bad. They just didn't run away from it.
Right.
That's what I always gravitated towards. That's the type of comic that I was. Let's go back to your early days, man, because you just started talking. You was like in the beginning, you know, so before you had the success, when did things start to heat up a little bit? Because you say after you got engaged, you know, your material, of course, changed, and that's when the opportunities came. Could you feel a progression at a certain point in your career before you got engaged, like as a comic, when you started to develop more?
Well, I felt I was becoming stronger on stage, you know. I felt a little more confident. The career reached a point where I was, you know, a regular at all the clubs in the city, in New York. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of guys went on the road a lot. I kind of didn't go on the road as much. I went once a month, twice a month, and then I stayed in the city and made all, you know, I would do, you know, five spots on Friday, seven spots on Saturday, and just make money in the city. And that, you know, and then at that point, there were a lot of stand-up shows on TV. That's when that was starting, you know.
That's when that was the big time.
MTV, VH1, yeah, all that. Mm-hmm. And so I started getting picked to do all those. My act was getting stronger. I don't know that I was becoming bigger nationally or anything. I wasn't. Like I say, in 91, I got the Tonight Show, but in 91, this is 4 or 5 months before he retired, Johnny. It was still the plateau for a comedian. It was still the mountaintop, but it wasn't like it was in the 70s or 80s, you know. In the 70s or 80s, you did the Tonight Show, and your life changed the next day, you know, your career. this was a great achievement, but it didn't really change my life. It gave you more credibility and all that. If I'm picking the one, I don't know if you want to go this, if I'm jumping ahead of what you wanted to talk about, but the moment that changed my, I don't want to, you know, saying changed my life is a little bit too grand, but was Letterman. It was when I did Letterman, because Letterman was, I had been doing a stand-up for 11 years when I got Letterman. So I had already done I did the Tonight Show with Leno. I did all the shows. I did all the stand-up shows. And that's when they were giving out development deals to a lot of guys. There were already guys that already made it. Tim Allen, Roseanne, they already gotten it. And a lot of guys were just getting development deals. And I, at that point, had been on pretty much everything. And no one was knocking on my door, really, for a development deal of any kind. And it's not like I wanted to, I had to get on TV. I had to have a development deal. I had to have a sitcom. That wasn't my goal in stand-up. The goal in stand-up was to be a stand-up. I mean, I love being a stand-up. But I just thought at that point, 11 years in, if it doesn't happen, maybe this isn't going to happen. I was 36 years old at that point.
Oh, wow.
And I thought, I love doing stand-up. If the next step doesn't happen, it doesn't happen.
It doesn't happen. And what was the mindset to walk away? If it doesn't happen, when you say that?
No, not from stand-up. No. But what happened was, actually, I'm jumping one thing. I got cast in News Radio. I don't know if you remember News Radio. It was Joe Rogan. He was on a sitcom with Phil Hartman. And I got cast on it. He saw my HBO special, and he had me come in and read. And I wasn't that good then at going in for reads. I was pretty bad. But somehow I got lucky, and that one clicked. And he flipped the guy. It was Paul Sims, was the creator of News Radio. And he said, "You're it. You're my guy." And flew me to L.A. We went up in front of the studio. And I could feel the second time I read in front of the studio, I wasn't that as good, but the guy loved it. But Sims had loved me so much from the audition that he pushed it through. And so I'm on this cast. The show is going to go because it's Phil Hartman, Andy Dick. It's on NBC. Jim Burrows is directing it. You knew it was a go. And now I'm on this show. I'm one of the cast members. And my wife and I are freaking out. I'm going to make $8,000 a week, Yeah. And she's in LA she's in New York with three, I have twins and a daughter. She's got the three little kids. And now I'm out there. It's December. And it's a table read. And the table read, the audition was a 10 out of a 10. The reading for the studio was a 7 out of 10, and the table read was like a 5 out of 10, But still, they're just saying, no, I know Paul Sims was so into me that he was like telling everybody it's fine. And then the first day of rehearsal, if I'm being truly honest, I could feel I wasn't ready, wow. And I was pushing and everything, and I was coming up, there was a little bit of improv going on. I was coming up with some stuff, but if you put a gun to my head, I would say, I'm not ready for this. I'm not the guy. And the next morning, I got the call, and it was just that call. I had to be on the set at like 8, and at 6:30 in the morning, in the hotel room, the phone rings and it's my manager. And you pick up the phone and it's 6:30, it's your manager. He's not telling you, hey, you did great yesterday. He's telling you the news. And the news was the cliche. They're going in another direction. And the other direction was Joe Rogan. Joe Rogan took my place. Yeah. So that was a blow, it was a relief. Deep down, it was a relief because I knew I was in over my head. And it was about 5 months later that I did Letterman. And Letterman led to Everybody Loves Raymond. Letterman produced Everybody Loves Raymond.
Wait a minute. Get out of here. I did not know that. Are you serious?
Yeah. Worldwide Pants. Yeah.
Holy shit. You going on Letterman, performing in Letterman, and he saw the set, fell in love with the set?
Yeah, I did Letterman, and And, you know, it was a really good spot. You know, my Carson spot was like a, I like to work in numbers. It was like an 8 out of 10. Letterman was like a 9.5 out of 10, you know?
I love that you're very specific with your numbers. It's such a good rating system. It was, you're thinking about it. 8 out of 10 for sure, Carson.
I'm OCD and anal, so I like the numbers. the following week, I did Letterman. And then I thought to myself, well, now I've done it. You know, I've done everything. This was my first Letterman. And if anybody's interested, you know, I don't know what else I can do. And Letterman was the only one interested. They called on a Saturday afternoon. This is true. I was in Queens at my house in Queens with my wife and Rob Burnett. Rob Burnett, who was running Letterman, then called himself and said, hey, Dave really loved it. He goes, we're interested in signing it to a deal. So don't, you know, if anybody else comes around asking, just hold off. And I told him, nobody's coming around, man. You're it. And I signed.
What honesty. What negotiating tack right there, right? Nobody else. Don't worry about that. Nobody else is knocking on my door.
It's funny you say that. It's funny because I want to jump ahead, but just while we're on that subject, I was on the show Parenthood, you know? And and the way I got on Parenthood was I knew the showrunner, and it was year 3 of Parenthood, and this was my show, just got canceled, Men of a Certain Age. I did a show called Men of a Certain Age that I created, and that was 2 years and out. So I actually liked Parenthood, so I called him up and I said, congratulations on the finale. I go, listen, if I'm unemployed now and I will work. And he said, we can't afford you. And I go, let me tell you something. Whatever my agent tells you I cost, don't listen to it. I'm not doing this for the money. And about 3 days later, my agent called me and said, did you tell Jason Kadams you would work for any amount of money? I go, yes, I did. And I was on Parenthood it's a funny story because it was the same amount of money that I was going to get on news radio. So I came full circle.
Yeah. And why was that when you said it's not for the money? What was the reason for that?
I mean, that was when I had done 9 years of Raymond. Mm-hmm. You know, I loved it, and it's my sitcom legacy, and I'm proud of it. But I was moving on now, and I was trying to dip my toe in the drama area, you know, and it's very hard for people to see you that way when they see you for 9 years as the sitcom boy, you know? Mm-hmm. So first I created my own show with Mike Royce. Me and him created this show called Men of a Certain Age. And that was on for 2 years at TNT. And it was a dramedy, 1 hour. And it was well received, but nobody was watching it.
I remember the show because it was like after you came back with another show and it was like, okay, that's pretty damn dope. Like, you went and created something else. It was like, I remember Men of a Certain Age. I damn sure do remember.
Yeah, yeah. Well, good. Thank you. But it was, yeah, we won a Peabody Award and then we got canceled. If you win the Peabody Award, it means they like you, but nobody's watching. So we got canceled. And then I did enjoy watching Parenthood. And I knew the guy, Jason Kadams. And at that point, you know, I'm going to be honest, I wasn't making financial decisions at that time. I was lucky that I didn't have to. I just said, boy, I'd love to get involved in that, you know?
This is Luxury.
And Diallo.
The hosts of One Song. And we'd like to thank the United Soybean Board for the sustainable makeover of our podcast studio and for sparking discussions on greener Hollywood production. Check out the Tears for Fears episode of One Song and see behind-the-scenes clips of how they pulled the whole look together. It's all on @HeartbeatAudio on YouTube, and the link is in our show notes.
Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean
every time. Because messes happen. Because...
Hey, listen. Remember how you told me to toss those takeout containers before we left for vacation? And you were like, I'm serious. If that leaks over the counter, it'll be a slimy abomination by the time I get back. And I was like, yeah, of course. Don't worry about it. I won't forget. Well...
Ooh, yeah, that happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed. Rinse after use if in contact with food surface.
I love that you said, you know, your sitcom legacy, right? It's funny that you said that because that's where I was going next. You know, you're attached to one of the greatest sitcoms of all time. You talk about a 9-year run. You know, when this happens, right, the beginning stages of sitcom, I mean, the fact that Letterman produced it, I did not know that. He's in, you know, Letterman is a guy that, you know, people said back then wasn't like the nicest or most pleasant to comics. So for Letterman to see you be a fan, et cetera, attach himself, develop this thing, you get picked up, right? Give me your mindset then. Like now, you know, the guy that didn't go on the road, the guy that stayed true to the spots in the city, well, all of a sudden you got a sitcom that's picked up. This is the comic's dream. You're in a prime time state of stand-up comedy where this was the goal. It was all about the TV show. It wasn't about the movies. It wasn't about being the movie star. For comedians, the segue to success was your material somehow being a representation of what your TV show could be. And you had that. You were that. And it just happened. So what's your mind at that point?
I mean, first of all, I was scared out of my mind about the acting part of it. And yes, it was based on my life, the show. So that was the good thing is that it was... If it didn't feel organic acting, I was going to make it. We were going to rewrite it. I didn't have to do somebody else's words, you know? I mean, yes, I did. Phil mm-hmm. Rosenthal, who ran the show. I mean, we collaborated together, but it was for me, so I could have that say. But there was still no guarantee of anything. I had to go out to LA, leave my family there, and for the first year. It was a whirlwind of not really believing, first of all, that it's going to stick around, because the first thing, we were on Friday night when nobody watched sitcoms, and we were in like 110th place. So we didn't even...
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And what happened was... no, and also, nobody knew the show, so the audience that they would bring in were... And this is not a joke, it's going to sound like a joke, but they would get them from senior citizen homes, rehab centers, and prison is mm-hmm. what I heard. Like, and they would
there you go. Yes.
They would bless them.
That's
in.
A good crowd.
And and nobody knew the characters. You know, the first we weren't on the air. We had to film like five or six episodes before we even aired. So these people coming in to watch are seeing, you know, my mother walk in the room, and, you know, we were writing jokes based on character. We were trying not to write jokes, and nobody knows this character yet. Nobody knows that she's the overbearing, pushy mother who's going to say something insulting to the wife, you know? So they, you know, the shows, we just had to trust that they were funny, and it was not easy. You know, the confidence level was not crazy, but I do remember there was an episode. It was about the fourth or fifth episode, and I just remember feeling it all kind of click. And I do remember a moment where I thought to myself, something could be happening here. Something might be happening, you know? I was staying, I got a room in an apartment, and Peter Boyle was renting also. He's a New Yorker. And I remember on day one, I was this Peter Boyle, you know, a movie star.
Big deal.
Yeah. And he doesn't know who I am. And everything's revolving around this guy's story. And I was scared, you know, and I remember day one of rehearsal, we hadn't said anything to each other. And in between scenes, we were passing each other. And he just stopped me and said, it's just like water. Just let it flow. And then he just kept going. And I have no idea what it meant. I knew it was some actory thing.
But it made you feel better.
But yes, just
it made
because
you feel better.
He took that time to try to calm me down. You know, I always remember that. And we became best. We became really good friends, me and him.
Well, you're talking about a show, like I said, once again, it went 9 season. And, you know, for all of my listeners that aren't familiar, I mean, Ray Romano's TV show was unreal, right? I mean, from the cast, from the comedy, I mean, you're talking about some of the best TV writing to ever be done. You develop a relationship with the cast, right? Over the years, as a comedian, did you stay true to your comedic roots, or did you find yourself kind of backing away from comedy as the show was gaining more success?
No. We did. I did comedy all the time during hiatus. And one year we did a tour and we filmed it. And it was a documentary called 95 Miles to Go. One of the writers was my friend, Tom Caltabiano, and he was a big into photography and all that. And he would open up for me. I met him through stand-up. And so during a hiatus, we were just going to do a little tour through the South and drive from Florida up. And he said, let's film it. And I didn't really want to. And that's kind of the documentary is, it's against my will that he's filming it. And it was on HBO, right? Actually, it was on HBO for like 10 minutes, 95 miles to go. Yeah. But I never gave up. I never will give it up, stand up. I go, you know, that's the cellar. You mentioned the cellar. Whenever I'm in New York, without a doubt, I'm going to the cellar, you know, and doing spots. Funny thing is, are you in LA?
I'm in LA.
I've been in LA for 20 some odd years, and I don't go to the clubs here. I can't figure out why I don't just suck it up and go to the clubs. I don't know.
You don't like the scene, or you just don't?
No, I don't know the scene. You know, I've been there throughout my years. I've been there and on, but I just feel like I'm when I'm not in New York. I don't know. I don't feel like. I don't know. I really want to get back in there and get up because I can't just wait till I go to New York every time.
I can tell you this. I can tell you that it's not New York.
Yeah.
I can tell you that there's no place like New York. The energy that surrounds New York in comedy is just, it's insane. Yeah. You know, there's no place like it at all. LA is just different. You know, it's a little more laid back. And the setting, for me, the setting is different because, you know, it's not as consistent, right? Like, and I feel like the comedians just have a different approach. Like, it's always about tonight could be the night to be discovered. And there is no, like, the work side of it, the really beating up the material, the working on the jokes and the new set and prep, you know, like every, I feel like every time I'm on the scene or have been on the scene, those younger comics is just, it's a different energy, but it's one of, once again, like who's out there. Right. This could be the night I get discovered. Like there's that attachment to it. I mean, I'm working on a new hour now. So, you know, I've been going out, but I just,
where's your room?
I go to the Ha-Ha, I go to the Comedy Store, I go to the Improv, I go to the Laugh Factory. I've been going to this place called The Chateau.
Where's the Ha-Ha?
The Ha-Ha is in the Valley. It's off of Lancashire.
Oh, yeah. I know where that is. Yeah.
The Ha-Ha isn't bad.
It's a good room,
It's a good room. You know where else I go? I go Flappers in Burbank.
I've been on Flappers one time.
Great crowds. Great intimate comedy club. You know, I like the intimate spots. I like the spots that are really closed in, crammed up, where I can see the actual people. You know, I want to see all the faces if I can.
I like Flappers because I had one joke about it. I go, Flappers, it's a stupid joke. I go, Flappers is a place where women go to work if they're too old for Hooters. I don't know what the hell.
I get it just because I've seen the staff. I get exactly what you're saying. So you don't go up at all in L.A.? You don't go up at all?
I mean, the last time I went up, I did the big Kumail Nanjiani. We did the Big Sick together, the movie, and... He he didn't drag me on, but he gave me the guy at the Comedy Store's number, who's not there anymore, right? There was a guy who books it now, who's not booking it now. I forget who, now it's a woman who books it, right? So I called up and the guy said, come in anytime. And I went in and it did about two spots. And that was about 3 years ago. Where do you go in New York?
New York, I'm everywhere. New York, I mean, I mainly like that the Cellar's new setup now. You know, the cellar has the Cellar, and then right around the corner, there's the other two spots, the Underground and the other spot above it. So, you know, I can go there and just do three every night. And
I know,
be good,
I know.
You know, I don't have to leave from down there.
I know.
And then you have to sit down. And New York is good just because of the opportunity to sit down at that table and hang out, right? Like that's the most important part. And without the hanging out, we got nothing. I love the hanging out.
I
miss the hanging out. That's also another thing that I miss, you know, when I'm here in LA. But like, once again, it's a different scene. And I think the comics that have started here, that are here, thrive off of the environment here. Like, it's different for them.
Right,
but
right,
if you
right.
come, if you come from the East Coast, you come out here, there's a dramatic difference. There's just a, it's just a drop off in energy, the most.
Yeah. Maybe that's it. I don't know. Maybe that's what's holding me back. I don't know, but I got to get out there, because especially now, you know, I just wrote and directed a movie.
Oh, wow.
And it, we picture locked, and we're almost coming to the end of this whole, this thing, this journey that took like 5 years, and it's almost coming to an end, and it scares me, you know, because I'm like, that's how I work, where if I have nothing on the landscape, it's bad news for me, you know.
Okay.
Yeah.
When you say it's bad news, you also mentioned that you have an OCD, you said anxiety, stuff like that. Is there a fear of what? Like, is not working, does it have a different definition for you? If you're not working, if you're not doing something, does it fuck with you?
Yeah, I think I'm neurotic and anxious when I'm working and when I'm not working, but I think it's worse if I'm not working. I think the way I phrase it is, I got to keep moving or I catch up to myself.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Okay. I actually understand what you're saying, though.
Yeah.
I understand busy, what you're saying.
And creative, you know, it's not just work for the sake of work. I mean, it's the creative side of it, though, too. You know, that's why stand-up will never go away for me, because you can't get more of your creative juices going than with stand-up, you know.
But directing is pretty creative as well. If you bite that directing stick,
that was scary.
You know.
Have you done it?
I have, but I'll say I co-directed, right? Like I did an episode of my TV show, Real Husbands of Hollywood, that I directed, but I had to share the editing experience because I didn't have time.
Right.
A lot, you know, right. you have to answer every question.
I know, man, it's crazy.
That's a different hat to put on. So when you're talking about creative, I mean, goodness.
Yeah, it's crazy. It was the most nerve-wracking thing for me because I'd never done it. I'd never done it. All my TV and my episode, I never directed one episode.
What made you want to do it?
Well, I wrote the script. I wrote the script and I didn't want to do it. But it was it's a kind of autobiographic, not really, but inspired by stuff in my real life. And when it came time to do it, my agent said, why don't you direct it? And I immediately said, no. First of all, I know nothing about cameras. I don't know lenses from anything, you know? I mean, I know about the performance I want to get. That I know, but I would really have zero input into the camera work, you know, except what I know what I want it to look like. And I just felt someone else could do a better job. But he kind of convinced me that it's too personal a story. You know, you surround yourself with good people. You surround yourself with a great cinematographer and a great AD. And, you know, I took care of the performance and I had a great cinematographer who really took care of the look of it. And, But I got to tell you, I swear, leading up, we went to New York February for prep, and it was going to start filming in April. And the first week of when I got there in February, I called up my agent and said, can't do it. Cannot do this. I had to go for a stress test. I had to go for the treadmill and everything, man. It was just too much for me to think.
Why about. Was it because of all the answers that you had to have, everything that you had to be?
Well, that I knew was coming. Everything I knew that was coming. Okay. Yes.
Okay.
Everything I knew that I was diving into this unknown, camera shots, actors, directing actors. Laurie Metcalf played my wife, you know. I got to tell her what if I don't phrase it right? What if actors, you gotta, when you gotta tell them they're doing it wrong, you gotta tell them they're doing it right first, you know? And then ease into it.
Yeah, it's all you're doing is dealing with personalities all day as a director.
Yeah.
And that's from the top to the bottom. You know, you're managing personalities. Before you go and have the conversation about getting what you want, you got to make sure that you make them feel comfortable enough about what they're doing.
Right.
Hey, man,
right.
You're doing a good job.
Yeah.
Hey,
yeah.
I just want to say we appreciate you. Hey, right. This set would not be the same without your hard work.
Yeah.
Now, with that being said, is there any way that I can get you to?
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, you have to play that yin and yang game.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And having said that, they were all great. Yeah. Sebastian was in it. Sebastian Maniscalco.
Yeah.
And Eric Griffin, you know, Eric Griffin.
Yes, I do know Eric Griffin.
He did a little spot for us too.
I love Sebastian, man.
Yeah. He was great.
Sebastian did his podcast as well. Sebastian's a talented guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very, very talented guy.
He was good. He wasn't funny. He played my younger, kind of obnoxious brother, and he was very good. Yeah.
This is Luxury.
And Diallo.
The hosts of One Song. And we'd like to thank the United Soybean Board for the sustainable makeover of our podcast studio and for sparking discussions on greener Hollywood production. Check out the Tears for Fears episode of One Song and see behind-the-scenes clips of how they pulled the whole look together. It's all on @HeartbeatAudio on YouTube, and the link is in our show notes.
Where's your mindset at now? What does Ray Romano want to do now? Right, like you're talking to me about directing, and you're saying that.
Yeah, that's just it. That's what I'm talking about. That's the scary part. Is when we still got a lot of work to do on this, but when this, I see the finish line now, and that's a scary thing. I mean, do I write another script? This thing took 6 years to write. I'm not going to do that. How freaking old can you be in this business? I mean, but stand-up is the one thing that doesn't go away, thank God, when I go on at the Cellar, they still want to hear what I have to say, mm-hmm. For some comics, let's be honest, some comics hold up as they get older,
yeah.
And some of them don't,
yeah.
Some of them don't.
Yeah.
And I don't, so far, I hope I'm not blind to it, I hope I know when I've overstayed my welcome as a stand-up,
I don't think there is a overstay your welcome. I think even if you
just say the audience.
Yeah, thing. Like even if you lose what you feel is your step, there's a way for you to get back a comfortable step for you, right? Like ultimately the craft, the audience gets to laugh at what we're presenting, but what we're presenting is more of an expression of self. So, as long as you're enjoying the world of expressing yourself and putting your truth out there, well, then people have the choice to gravitate towards it or not. I think that there's still joy that can be found in just doing the craft, regardless of age, if I am doing it, let's just say if I am, I'm definitely going to be the old guy telling those long stories, sitting on the stool. I know I am. And if they're with me, great. If they're not, I know that you at least listen.
Yeah. Yeah. You still get the high from writing new stuff and all, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I have to write. I have to create. That's why I got excited when you were talking about, you writing and then directing. Like, that's the next tier of the business. What about developing a TV show? Have you ever thought about it? since you come from that space, you had such success in it. Have you ever thought about that?
I mean, we did it. We did it right after Raymond with mm-hmm. Men of a Certain Age. Mm-hmm. And it's a ton of work, man, you know?
Yeah.
It's a ton of work to write a new episode every week, you know? I mean, the movie thing is crazy, the amount of work, but you're concentrating on just getting this right. Where with the TV show, you've got to concentrate everything on getting this right, and then boom, cut, wrap. Now you've got to get the next one. You know what I mean? You're making a, I mean, if it's a single camera, you're making a little film every week. And I don't know if I'm down for that right now. You know, I would entertain doing another film, but and directing it, but I wouldn't direct. Like someone asked me, I'm on a show now on HBO Max called Made for Love. I'm playing a part, and they offered for me to direct an episode, and it doesn't interest me because it's somebody else's vision, it's someone else's words, it's someone else's characters they created, you know. So if I'm going to do any of that again, if I'm going to direct again, it's going to be something I wrote. But man, you know, have you written scripts? You've written scripts, yeah?
Yeah.
You know how crazy.
It's a lot of work.
It's a pain in the ass.
It's a lot of work. But I just see, I just think there's a lot of value in Ray Romano producing or spearheading television. You know, I mean, you know, there.
Oh, you mean just like a production company, you know, a production company.
Yeah, like Ray Romano attached to any type of TV is value, especially in the space of sitcom. I mean, you come with such an abundance of knowledge and success in this space? So I can't see a space where you won't get several opportunities to put together what you feel is a dream cast, a dream, you know, whether it's writers, showrunners underneath your company, and develop shows that you want to go to the next level.
I've had a couple of little offers to do something like that. And it just never, I don't know, man, if I got to, cause I don't want to, you know, go in halfway. I got to go in all the way. And I just don't know if it was going to be fulfilling for me to put in all that time and effort for something that just, you know, I get it though. I get what you're saying though. You know, it still can be fun to not be the guy on screen and not be the guy who wrote it, but the guy who put it together, you know?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like you don't have to sit down and do the writing, you know? Like you can have the other people do the writing for you, especially since you've done the writing. The idea becomes the big part.
Yeah.
And cracking the code on the ideas is where the work can come in. I just think that Ray Romano, once again, that name above or behind any TV show, has a strong chance at getting seen, getting on air. I mean, you know, you just, once again, you come with credibility. What's your relationship now with your comedy class? You know, you came up with such a strong class of comedians. Who were the comedians that were with you when you started comedy? Who do you remember being around?
Well, I mean, down at the Cellar, down in New York, it was Jon Stewart, Chappelle was there, Louis C.K. was there, Dave Attell, you know, Brian Regan and I had the same manager for 30 years. We still do.
Wow.
Kevin James, of course, you know, Kevin James and I, we did a movie mm-hmm. together, and we've done a bunch of stuff together. Who else? Seinfeld was before me, you know. Seinfeld was about 5-6 years before me. He was even more than that, maybe mm-hmm. 7. He was out there already. But yeah, those were the guys.
Are you still in touch? Who are you still in touch, or do you still talk to any of those guys?
You know, there was a time where Kevin and I were super tight. And then, you know, life takes over. He's got 4 kids. He lives in Florida now. But we still talk, you know. He's actually doing his own movie now. So we just had a long talk because he wanted to pick my brain about the directing and all.
Mm-hmm.
Brad Garrett from my show.
Yes. Brad plays poker. Brad's a poker guy.
Funniest guy ever.
By far.
Him and I are good. If I'm saying, if there's one comic I'm closest with, it's probably Brad Garrett right now. You know, David Spade and I work the Mirage now. We co-headline, we do... we do like 5 or 6 times a year. We do a weekend at the in Vegas, and we got one coming up actually.
It's another very funny guy. Spade is very funny, man. Life funny too. Like Spade is in person funny as well.
Yes, yes. But I used to do it with Brad. Brad and I used to do the Mirage, and it would be, we had another friend who would open up for us, and then he would do a half hour, and I would do a half hour, and then we'd do a Q&A after. And after about 2 or 3 weekends, I just told him, we have to flip it. I can't go on after you. Yeah. I don't know if you've seen. Have you seen him live?
Yes. Yes. Brad Garrett is hilarious.
Yeah, he's in the audience. He's saying everything he shouldn't say. It's hysterical, you know?
He's strong. Yeah. Brad, energy's different.
Yeah,
it's a lot.
So it's a lot. I said, it's a better show. Let me go on. And he did. He flipped it. He was, and now he has a club. He owns a club in Vegas.
Oh, get out of here. I didn't know that.
And it just,
what club?
It was Brad Garrett's Comedy Club at the MGM, and then COVID and all, and it went down. And he just opened it again last week. He had a grand opening last week. Yeah.
Good for him, man. Yeah, good for him.
No, he's the good. He's the great.
Well, I can tell you what, Ray, man. It's good to hear you just talk about the business, talk about you still having ambition and wants and still having a drive, you know. After success, that's what most people lose. People lose the drive. People lose the energy behind wanting to get up and figure it out. And you seem to still have it. You know, that anxiety, that OCD that you're talking about, well, it seems like a great battery that gets you up and that gets you moving, just so you're not stagnant, man. And there's a point in time where every comedian, well, they wanted the TV show. They wanted the success behind the sitcom. And there's only a few that actually got it. I mean, I can probably count on 2 hands, the comedians that actually got it and had crazy success doing it. You know, you, Tim Allen, Seinfeld, D.L. Hughley, Steve Harvey, Martin Lawrence. The list starts to get thin. Damon Wayans. Kevin James, right? You like, the list is not a strong list. David Spade had TV success, but it wasn't his show, but he acted as the comedy relief. But the comedians that actually did that and that had longevity there, you know, I feel like there should be a Hall of Fame for that group, because that group, Roseanne, Monique, you know, Thea Vidal, it's not a lot. There should be a fucking a Hall of Fame of the comedians that actually transferred the stage into TV, because their material was that vivid. It was that amazing. The pictures they painted could be seen clearly by audiences to the point where it was such an easy decision to make that into a show. Cosby, same thing. Like, these are all pioneers that have done it, man. And dude, it's a pleasure to talk to you just because you're in that space. I never really got to talk to you, but Ray, I do believe in giving people their flowers. I do believe in making sure people understand that they have an impact and have made one. And you, my friend, have done that. You've done that in a major way. So I want to say, dude, don't let this be your last picture that you directed. Yes, it's a bunch of fucking work. Yes, it'll drive you crazy. You may be on 2 more stress tests. Yes, that is a possibility. But it keeps you present, man. And look at the world of producing some TV. Put that name above some stuff, man. You got the eye. There's no reason why you can't. You did it 2 times, and those things got the air. So, you know, create some shit for this younger generation where they can look at it and possibly have some longevity, too. You're a fucking rock star, dude.
Well, I appreciate it. I appreciate it. Coming from you, man, I really appreciate this, you know, because if anybody knows what you're describing,
absolutely,
it's you.
Absolutely. Yeah. This is why I do it, though. I do this for that reason at all, man. It's about showing love to the other people that are in this fraternity, this frat that we call comedy, man. I love it. Yeah. I live it, and I love that you're still doing it. You got to get some places in L.A. You just got to go.
I know.
You got to get up. You got to get out, man.
I will. Believe me.
Just go. No reason why.
Believe me, I'm going crazy here, not going up. So we will soon, and maybe we'll see each other in New York again.
For sure. Listen, if you're there, I will say I'm probably going to be there. for some periods of time in December before Christmas for sure.
Yeah, we might go too. I have a place. I have a place there. I have an apartment. So we, you know, my family's and my wife's family are all East Coast. So we go back and forth all the time.
Yeah, you'll definitely see me if you are there before the holidays. You'll definitely see me there. I'm gonna go and
you go down and sell it. You go down and sell
Yeah, that's right. What I'm telling you. You'll see me there. I don't do anything else. I just do that run. Those three rooms.
Can I go on before you?
That's if yes, 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 you can. Yes, you
if
can.
You notice, I'm a wimp. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you're a smart wimp with tons of credibility and success. Ray, thank you so much to my audience. This is Comedy Gold Mines. You know what we do here. We get inside the minds of brilliant comedians. And oh my God, today, what an amazing mind we had. Oh, yes, boy. There's a little bit of anxiety in there and a little bit of OCD in there. But all together, it's wrapped up into an amazing individual that understands comedy and that has a love for the craft. And that's what we walk away today knowing. A man still loves the craft. And for that, we love him. Thank you so much, Ray.
All right, man. Thank you.
Comedy Gold Mines is a Sirius XM and LOL audio production. Executive produced by Kevin Hart, Ty Randolph, and Eric Weil. With Tastemakers Media, Emil Garner, and Ian McDonald.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. The Daily Show podcast has everything you need to stay on top of today's news and pop culture. You get hilarious, satirical takes on entertainment, politics, sports, and more from Jon and the team of correspondents and contributors. The podcast also has content you can't get anywhere else, like extended interviews and a roundup of the weekly headlines. Listen to The Daily Show, Ears Edition, wherever you get your podcasts.
Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because...
the charcoal mask. Great, because why would I put that on my face when I could drop it in my sink?
This is what I get for multitasking.
Ugh, why is charcoal so sticky?
Hello?
Hey, Janice. I am so sorry. I thought I was on mute.
No, we don't need to reschedule. I'll just stay off camera.
Ooh, yeah, that happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed.